You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood. Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC, a registered broker-dealer.
Welcome back to Silver Screen Cinema Classics, where legendary films never go out of style, and neither do we. I'm regular host Michael Wilson, and tonight we're slipping into our finest grey suits and boarding the 20th Century Limited straight into the world of espionage, elegance, and incredibly poor luck at the hands of mistaken identity. Now, while more guests were meant to join this caper, a few have tumbled off the train along the way, but fear not, like a femme fatale with perfect aim and sharper dialogue, one star came through. Our very own Eve Kendall with style, wit, and a hint of mystery. It's my podcast partner for today and regular lifesaver, Sandy Evanson.
Welcome. Hi, Mike.
You looking forward to this one?
Yeah.
Awesome, awesome. Well, together we're decoding the charm and suspense of Alfred Hitchcock's 1959 classic, North by Northwest, a film where nobody is who they say they are, except maybe James Mason. So pour a martini, watch out for low-flying planes, and hold on tight, because this one's going off the rails in the best possible way. And I should, as I conclude the scripted portion, I should basically point out that, as I said, we were going to have other guests, but it's ended up just being the two of us, and it's in a weird kind of quirk of coincidence, this is the first time that we've both seen North by Northwest, so you're going to get very fresh opinions, because I don't know about you, but I literally watched it like 2 days ago, Sandy.
I literally watched it. Well, I started it last night and then restarted. I couldn't stay up. So today is my first day viewing it from start to finish.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. Well, I appreciate you doing that for the podcast then and fitting it in, squeezing it into your schedule. So, yeah, it's not easy for 2 and a bit hours. It's a long movie. But, that's fair enough. So, yeah, well, normally I would always start by saying, oh, what is your first experience with this film? But as we know, we both don't have one. It literally is just watching it for the podcast. But I was saying just off air, there's a reason for me choosing to watch this other than, well, there's a few really. So I'm going to get into a little bit about my history with it. First of all, the chap I used to live with, a guy called Chris, my old housemate when I was at university, used to really big this up as being like his number one film of all time. He absolutely loved it. So I kind of had his recommendation on it, even though I knew I'd never seen it. And I've seen a lot of other Hitchcock films, but never this one for some reason. And then there was a sort of season of classic films at my local Tyneside cinema, the little art house cinema, last year. And I was really planning on going to it, and then in the end I just wasn't able to. So I did go out and kind of buy Blu-rays of the various films that were going to be shown, including one of them was North by Northwest. And I was like, I know I'm not going to get around to watching it unless I put it on the podcast list. So I definitely did, because I'd heard so many good things about it. And that's the kind of how I'm approaching it, is with a lot of hype. Whether that's good or bad, we'll see. And like I said, with definitely having wanted to see it, and I'm kind of glad I have. Like I said, it was it was one of those things that's a huge gap in my kind of film knowledge. And yeah, we'll talk about it. There's lots of iconic scenes and stuff like that. So yeah, before we get truly into it then, Sandy, can you tell me what your first impressions were of this without any heavy spoilers? Just a general impression of the film after watching?
Yeah, I was actually generally surprised by the entire content matter and how, to me, it didn't seem like a Hitchcock film or what we think of as Hitchcock, as far as his more popular films, right? Psycho, The Birds, things that are more scary as opposed to a thriller. And that's just from my limited exposure to Hitchcock films. And, you know, that's I'm not saying that's true, but that was like my first impression. I was just surprised at the subject matter.
Yeah, no, I actually agree with you. I will probably get into that a little bit. And I know I do in my conclusion that it's not necessarily what I respond to from the Hitchcock films, although one of my favorites is also a similar kind of thriller. It's a Rear Window. But as you said, the majority of what I think of tends to be more leaning towards horror, and certainly not kind of just your fairly standardish spy tropes nowadays anyway, apart from The Whole Mistaken Identity, which I think I've heard is very Hitchcocky, the kind of, oh, it's just a normal person that gets roped into things and ends up in a huge mess that they, you know, don't deserve or whatever. So yeah, I'm sure there are Hitchcock scholars that will be laughing at us now, like, oh, that's a regular common thing. But
right.
Like I said, I haven't seen a load of Hitchcock movies, but I've seen probably a good sort of 10. And yeah, so as I say, we'll kind of approach it from that. When neither of us either, you know, Hitchcock legendary, you know, scholars, like I said, we haven't studied Hitchcock in, I presume, any real depth or detail, just kind of casually. So yeah, although we do have a review of Psycho on the channel that we reviewed last Halloween, actually, on Cinema Classics. So if you want to see our thoughts on that, you can. But yeah, so there's not really much else to add, because I know I've definitely asked you in the past for your favorite cinema classics, Sandy, so I don't need to ask you that again. And so just out of curiosity then, it's just occurred to me that this is potentially a question I can ask you. Have you seen many other Hitchcock films, and do you have a particular favorite yourself?
Psycho and The Birds are, again, what come to mind. I know I've seen a few others, but Psycho is one that I just always kind of clung to and, you know, were willing to rewatch and recommend to other people because I liked it, because it was so unique for the, you know, for the time, and really hasn't been redone in that way. I mean, it's been redone, but I mean, it hasn't been that.
Well, even when it was redone, though, they specifically did a kind of shot-for-shot remake because they didn't. I mean, it's the most pointless remake ever for that reason.
Right. That one's just kind of my favorite.
Yeah, I mean, we gave it a glowing review, obviously, spoiler alert. So you can see, I won't get into the reasons why here, but you can see the reasons why myself and DK loved it by checking out that episode that we've done in the past. But it's a very different kind of movie than we were expecting, potentially, even though, like I said, I know it's very, you know, it's actually quite full of Hitchcock-type tropes, which, again, we'll get into. But I'll tell you what, we'll start with the behind the scenes, because I've got quite a lot, like I said, of background information I was saying off air about this film, because obviously it's very well known, it's very popular and classic, and it's Hitchcock, so there's lots of information about it. So again, if you feel the need to jump in at any point, Sandy, to kind of, yeah, you know, chime in on anything, or if it jogs your memory of anything, just feel free to interrupt me. There's only the two of us here, so that's fair enough. Starting with the behind the scenes then, the original screenplay for the film was written by Ernest Lehman and was intended to be the basis for, quote, the Hitchcock picture to end all Hitchcock pictures. Hitchcock often told journalists of an idea that he had about Cary Grant hiding from the villains inside Abraham Lincoln's nose and being given away when he sneezes. He speculated the film could be called The Man on Lincoln's Nose. Would have been a bit on the point, I think. It is one of several Hitchcock films, featuring a musical score by Bernard Herrmann, which includes Psycho, and an opening title sequence by graphic designer Saul Bass, which I think also includes that. The film was the first to feature extended use of kinetic typography in its opening credits. Now, Hitchcock's cameo appearances are a signature occurrence in most of his films. In North by Northwest, did you spot it, Sandy?
Yes, and I had read about it, so I was looking for it.
Okay. Yeah, it's pretty obvious. He's seen getting a door slammed in his face as his credit appears on the screen, so it's not the most hidden or subtle of Hitchcock's cameos. There are some people who think that he appears later on in drag on the train, but it's actually just an actress who's a little overweight, so it's not Hitchcock. I know, right? Apparently she was a regular at Hitchcock movie, so she did all right for herself. There we go. In the year 2000, The Guardian ranked the crop duster scene from the movie at number 29 on their list of the top 100 film moments. British film magazine Empire ranked it as the greatest movie moment of all time in its August 2009 issue. A panel of fashion experts convened by GQ in 2006 said that the grey suit worn by Cary Grant throughout almost the entire film was the best suit in film history and the most influential on men's style, stating that it has since been copied for Tom Cruise's character in Collateral and Ben Affleck's character in Paycheck. This sentiment has been echoed by writer Todd McEwen, who called it gorgeous and wrote a short story, Cary Grant's Suit, that recounts the film's plot featuring the suit.
I wondered when I saw it if Mad Men drew, because he was an ad executive in New York in the 50s, 60s. I wondered if it drew from his appearance as well.
Very probably. I wouldn't be surprised. So, yeah, I mean, I haven't looked up that story, but I'm kind of curious to see what it's like if I can find it. But so, yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, from a, an attracted to men perspective, did you think it was an especially well-tailored, as they say, sort of look for Cary Grant?
I did.
Okay, cool. I have to say, I think the various fashion and everything's really good in this film, and I thought that Eva Marie Saint looks stunning throughout as well, from a different perspective.
No, truly.
Yeah, awesome. Well, Hitchcock has said that MGM wanted North by Northwest cut by 15 minutes so that the film's length would run under 2 hours. Hitchcock had his agent check his contract, learned he had absolute control over the final cut, and refused. I don't really think he should have, personally, but that's just my two cents. I think it's arguably 15 minutes too long, and there we go. Maybe he's a bit indulgent. This is such a funny sort of weird twist. One of Eva Marie Saint's lines in the dining car seduction scene was actually redubbed. She was supposed to say, "I never make love on an empty stomach," but it was changed in post-production to, "I never discuss love on an empty stomach," because the censors considered the original version too risque. 1959.
Yeah, I was actually surprised the lines they did cross in the movie for the era.
Yeah, there's a lot of, and very close to the bone seduction stuff and everything. So, Hitchcock planned this film as a change of pace after his dark romantic thriller Vertigo a year earlier. I really should watch that. Saying that he wanted to do something fun, lighthearted, and generally free of the symbolism permeating his other movies. Lehman has mocked those who look for symbolism in the film. But nevertheless, the film is considered to be a masterpiece for its themes of deception, mistaken identity, and moral relativism in the Cold War era. Some have mistaken the title as having come from a line in Hamlet. "I am but mad north, northwest, when the wind is southerly. I know a hawk from a handsaw." Don't think I'm competing with Ian McKellen for any roles there, but yeah, that's also a work concerned with the shifty nature of reality. However, Hitchcock explained in an interview with Peter Bogdanovich in 1963, "It's a fantasy. The whole film is epitomized in the title. There is no such thing as North by Northwest on the compass." And yeah, it's not one of the 30-odd points of the compass, apparently, so I wouldn't have known, to be perfectly honest. There is apparently a Northwest by North or something similar, but anyway. The film's plot involves a MacGuffin, a term popularized by Hitchcock, which is a physical object everyone in the film is chasing, but which has no deep relationship to the plot. Late in North by Northwest, it emerges the spies are attempting to smuggle microfilm containing government secrets out of the country. It kind of comes out of nowhere. But perhaps the most famous recent examples of this would be the briefcase from Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, or the Heart of the Ocean necklace in James Cameron's Titanic. So things that are not really important in any real way to the plot, but that everyone in the plot seems to act like it is. So, yeah. What did you think of that? Did you think that kind of... Because I was sort of like, that came out of very last minute at the end of the film.
No, actually, I thought it fit right in, because the whole time we're wondering what they were up to, and it turns out it was all about that.
I wasn't really even thinking about it like that. I was too busy worrying about the kind of mistaken identity and the fake person and whatever. So, yeah, anyway. North by Northwest has been referred to as the first James Bond film because of its splashily colourful settings, secret agents, and an elegant, daring, wisecracking leading man opposite a sinister yet strangely charming villain. The crop duster scene inspired the helicopter chase in From Russia with Love. The film was very influential on Bond films and subsequent action thrillers, as well as the TV series The Man from U.N.C.L.E., where Leo G. Carroll played the same sort of role as the head of a top-secret intelligence agency. he was the professor, I think the character's called in this one, the head guy. The third episode, I had to add this, of the 14th season of Doctor Who serial, The Deadly Assassin, in 1976, includes an homage to North by Northwest when the Doctor, who, like Hitchcock's hero, is falsely accused of a politically motivated murder, is attacked by gunfire from a biplane piloted by one of his enemy's henchmen. I'm sure there are multiple other examples of it. It's hugely pop culture kind of famous, that scene, but that was one that came up in my research and I felt like I had to add it, because otherwise I would have been betraying the beloved Doctor Who. So that's it for the behind the scenes, although I do have other bits in the various sections that we discuss. Does anything stand out to you from there, Sandy, or anything you wanted to discuss?
I also thought that Dr. Evil, with his Mount Rushmore of his own face, and climbing across that, I thought it might have been inspired by this as well.
Oh, definitely, yeah. It's as I said, this is not an official James Bond film, but it is basically, and that's something I didn't really know about the film until I had, obviously, when I watched it, I was like, very spy filmy. And then when I was reading that, I was like, I can definitely see what they mean by that, absolutely. And yeah, like I said, it's been parodied a load of times. I know there's an episode of Family Guy, North by North Cohog, which parodies like every bit of this film. It's got the biplane scene.
Have to watch that.
It's got the Mount Rushmore scene and everything in it. So it's not a particularly great episode, but it's just weird how it's like it uses all of the iconic stuff from North by Northwest. And
then I was also reading that the famous film festival, which is just north of where I live, the South by Southwest Film Festival, was inspired by the Hitchcock film North by Northwest.
Yes, that's where they got the title, apparently. Yeah.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Which I can understand.
Also, you know, not a compass point, I guess.
I think that actually might be, but it's just, I don't know. So, like I said, there's a lot of stuff in the film that surprised me and a lot of stuff that didn't, because, like I said, it's one of those films, and I've said this before when it comes to the cinema classics, it's one of those where I've seen clips from the film way more times than I care to admit and more times than I would ever have seen the film. So there's certain things where the scenes were coming up, as we said off air, that I was like, oh, I know what this is. Yeah, and I know this bit and I'm familiar with this. And but you know, it still flowed together really well, particularly things that like the end sequence I really liked on Mount Rushmore, even though I'd seen versions of it and clips of it. I think the whole thing pieced together makes a lot more sense. So if we've covered all the behind the scenes, I'm going to jump into the various sections. Again, if you're unfamiliar, you should probably know that we break it down into sections like writing, directing, acting, VFX production design, etc. But we just let the conversation flow if it goes a different way. I've said this a million times, but just in case anybody is newly listening and knows that we have some structure to this, albeit loose. So, I'm going to start by talking about the writing, because I have, again, a lot of information about this before I get into just random notes and things. Do you have anything you wanted to quickly say before I start, Sandy, about the writing?
Just that I thought it was really clever in some places. Trying to remember that, you know, this was done before other things. I think it was very unique that, you know, other things drew from it. But just even that that Kaplan wasn't a real person at all, and how the lengths they had gone to set up the fake identity of a non-person. I just thought that was really clever. And just the whole thoroughfare of how he got from point A of walking out, giving his secretary notes, to point B of hanging from the face of Mount Rushmore. I just thought that whole journey was pretty well written out.
Yeah, it's a bit of a whirlwind, and it kind of, in lesser kind of scripted hands, it could seem ridiculous how far we end up, but it kind of, it does work, as you're saying, it kind of, even though it's a comedy of errors almost, the way it's kind of mistaken identity, and then it goes further and further, and,
but the man with one red shoe type of thing.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And as you said, there's a lot of stuff here that was, seems very familiar, but we kind of owe it because it's the first one, and I know that happens again a lot in cinema classics, where it's like, well, this is just very familiar to me, but you have to acknowledge that, yes, it is, because everything borrowed from it, you know, exactly. in the future, so, yeah. Cool, well, I don't know if you know this, but the whole idea, I'll get into it a little bit, I've got notes about it, the whole idea about the kind of fake person that doesn't exist as a ruse, apparently comes from an actual real life situation. It's an actual thing. So yeah, be prepared to hear about that.
Oh, good, because I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Anyway, John Russell Taylor's 1978 biography, Hitch, The Life and Times of Alfred Hitchcock, suggests that the story originated after a spell of writer's block during the scripting of another film project. And I'm quoting here, Alfred Hitchcock had agreed to do a film for MGM, and they'd chosen an adaptation of the novel The Wreck of the Mary Deer by Hammond Innes. Composer Bernard Herrmann had recommended Hitchcock work with his friend Ernest Lehman. After a couple of weeks, Lehman offered to quit, saying he didn't know what to do with the story. Hitchcock told him they got along great together and they would just write something else. Hitchcock thought for a moment, then said he had always wanted to do a chase across Mount Rushmore. Lehman and Hitchcock spitballed more ideas, a murder at the UN headquarters, a murder in a car plant in Detroit, a final showdown in Alaska. Eventually, they settled on the UN murder for the opening and the chase across Mount Rushmore, sorry, for the climax. For the central idea, Hitchcock remembered something an American journalist had told him about spies creating a fake agent as a decoy. Perhaps their mysterious hero could be mistaken for this fictitious agent and end up on the run. They bought the idea from the journalist for $10,000. So, yeah. Otis Guernsey was that American journalist who had the idea which influenced Hitchcock, inspired by a true story during World War II, when British intelligence obtained a dead body, invented a fictitious officer who was carrying secret papers, and arranged for the body and misleading papers to be discovered by the Germans as a disinformation scheme called Operation Mincemeat. Guernsey turned his idea into a story about an American salesman who travels to the Middle East and is mistaken for a fictitious agent, becoming saddled with a romantic and dangerous identity. Guernsey admitted that his treatment was full of corn and lacking logic, and he urged Hitchcock to do what he liked with the story. An example of the corn in the finished screenplay is the scene where Roger Thornhill returns to the Townsend estate with the detectives to find everything changed. If Thornhill was indeed a spy, he would have had no reason to return to the estate after his escape the previous night, nor would the criminals be expecting him to return, as they obviously did. Yeah, that kind of stood out for me a little bit as well, so... So what did you think of the real-life influence for this? That's a bit of a weird one, isn't it? You wouldn't realize necessarily, so...
Right. It didn't stand out for me, though. It didn't strike me as odd, now that I'm thinking about it.
The plot hole thing, you mean? Yeah. It's a weird one. I think it stood out to me a little, and I was like, It seemed, because it is so kind of ludicrous, the idea that they do this whole charade, and I'm like, well, why would they do that? Unless they know he's actually not who they say he is. But so then it doesn't, yeah, it doesn't track hugely, but it's not a massive deal, I suppose.
Right, yeah, because I thought they were just there still, like, cleaning up and stuff like that, and she's carrying on with it because he's brought other people with him. Like, he's trying to prove that he's somebody else for his own reasons, and she's just playing along as a good spy does. I don't know.
Yeah,
that's really what I thought.
Yeah, it kind of works as a scene of kind of desperation for the hero, because I did find myself feeling, oh, I can imagine how frustrating and annoying that would be, and, you know, the way it's going through and nobody's believing him, and even his own mother is like, oh, just pay the $2. So, yeah. Are you aware, by the way, where that comes from, that phrase?
No,
I did. I had to look it up because I was like, what the heck does that mean? Apparently, there's a famous comedy sketch where there's a guy who gets like a $2 fine for parking in the wrong place or something quite innocuous, and spends like weeks on end trying to fight this charge and trying to protest his innocence. And the kind of punchline of this thing is literally just being told, just pay the $2.
Wow.
Rather than trying to fight it.
And I wonder how many contemporary jokes just flipped by. But they still work. For example, when he is taken aback by the officer's, the sergeant's name being Emil.
Yeah,
I was just wondering.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it either.
Where that came from. Whatever joke I'm missing, it still comes off as, even this day, pretentious to have a name and to announce and to pronounce it that way. So that's how I took it. But I'm sure there's many contemporary jokes that just flew by me.
There is another one that I haven't had a chance to look up, or I did, but I can't remember it. And I'm sure other people could look it up if you were bothered. But it's when he sees that Eve has the microfilm and he says, "Oh, I see you've got the pumpkin." It's a reference to something contemporary that we don't know of now. But
right. I wondered if I even heard that right.
Yeah. I don't know what it's a reference to. Again, I'm sure you could look it up if you're bothered, but it is definitely a contemporary reference.
I am just bothered.
Yeah. It doesn't really kind of affect anything, but I'll tell you what, I'll look it up just in case. Okay, fair enough. It's apparently a direct reference to the 1948 Alger Hiss case where Whittaker Chambers hid microfilm in a pumpkin on his farm. So Yeah, it's an actual case, basically, that happened, but it was obviously years ago, so it's not something
I'm
that really
hit our...
I'm going
to have to read into that later. That sounds intriguing.
Yeah. A lot of it seems to be based on kind of real-life espionage and stuff like that, so you can't say they didn't do their research and stuff like that, you know? So.
And I forget that the Cold War, I always think of it as being more of an 80s thing, but evidently it was getting kicked off at this time, and I never really realized that.
Well, not just kicked off. I mean, as the professor says in the film, they're losing at this point, you know. So,
right.
But yeah, I mean, you think about it, the entire space race is part of the Cold War. It's kind of we have to get to the moon before Russia does.
Right.
So yeah,
we put our moon lasers on there before they do.
Plant the flag. Cool. Well, just as this is one of those things that's kind of there's often a lot of kind of historical debate when people have passed away, but screenwriter William Goldman has insisted that it was Lehman who created North by Northwest and that many of Hitchcock's ideas were not actually used. Hitchcock did have the idea of the hero being stranded in the middle of nowhere, but apparently suggested that the villains try to kill him with a tornado. Quote, "But they're trying to kill him. How are they going to work up a cyclone?" Lehman responded. Yeah. Goldman stated, "I just can't tell you who said what to whom, but somewhere during that afternoon, the cyclone in the sky became the crop duster plane." Yeah, I don't quite know how they were going to work out that the, you know, Hitchcock was going to have the bad guys control the weather, but, you know.
Yeah, that would have been complicated.
Yeah. And it is, it's such a clever thing, the whole sort of crop dusting plane idea. And again, it led to very iconic scenes. So
I thought so too.
Yeah, although I've never had any idea how that scene ends, because it's one of those where you always see the sort of tension of the scene and the plane chasing him and him dodging, but you never see the kind of explosion when it gets taken out at the end, you know?
Yeah, how did he get out of it?
Yeah, and it's quite clever in its own way, but yeah, awesome. So, well, that's kind of all the behind-the-scenes stuff I had on the writing. Is there anything else that you wanted to kind of mention before I get into the little bits?
Nothing I recall.
Fair enough. Well, yeah, one of the things that I was reading during my research was that part of the effectiveness of the film is that it's what they call a triple shell game plot, in that there's three distinct groups that all have their own kind of motivations and points of view from coming at. So you've got the kind of the CIA type agency, the actual villains, Van Damme's people, and then, you know, Roger Thornhill himself, the innocent man caught amongst all this. And when I read that, I was like, oh, yeah, that's actually a very good point. And it's the way they intersect that gives you the actual beat of the film. And again, it's a brave thing to do, having those, like, having three storylines, essentially, that that you can follow. And, you know, you have to kind of set them all up in their own way. And it's done quite well, I thought. I don't know if you would agree.
I would agree. I would add that there was even more than that, because, you know, the girl had her own even kind of quaternary. Yes. Line coming in too, how she got stuck there.
Yes, I was going to say that was going to be my very next question, actually, is that one of the things that struck me was that I was surprised throughout by the twists and turns, because I hadn't been spoiled, so I kind of didn't know about the Eve character. So, you know, when she first meets him, I was like, oh, very suspicious. And then obviously you get the moment of her talking to the bad guys, and then you fully believe, oh, she's a femme fatale and everything, as he does. And then the big reveal at the end that, oh no, she's actually a double agent, but she shoots him. And all these shocks, I was following them the whole way, and like, I'm shocked every time this happens. But yet that right. character turns out to be so interesting, the female character, because she is the one that's, as you say, she has the most kind of going on in the plot, and she has the most changes. Like, the, you know, I know Roger does go through a lot, and, you know, it develops into the kind of spy role almost, but I feel like she was the one that had the most interesting changes of character throughout, and the most growth in terms of from what you kind of first think she is. Do you agree? Or
yeah, and in fact, she's kind of the hero. He's the bumbling idiot who showed up and what could be of some use to her, but she was kind of the hero of the whole, if we're talking about who was most instrumental in recovering that microfilm.
Yeah, I did actually think that was very, again, forward-thinking and quite feminist. Not everything is in this film, but for 1959, the idea that it's the female character who was the, you know, secret agent, capable one, and he was the kind of, oh, I've ended up caught up in your world, and I have to kind of, it's a bit crappy that he has to try and save her, because as if she's not capable herself. But again, it was still brave to make her the, like you said, the central agent and the capable spy person, you know?
Yeah, and her... what I also appreciated to the, that feminist vibe was that her damsel in distress wasn't so distressy like they, you know, can be in films of this, you know, just kind of like the forearm across the eyes and or screaming, like a lot of screaming and being scared. And no, she rushed into she went everything head first, and I appreciated that for her character too.
Yeah, definitely the sort of scenes when she's going up to the house in Mount Rushmore and she says, like, look, I can take care of myself. I've got to do this. And he kind of doesn't want her to go, but she's starting to ground in all fairness. Like I said, I don't love that he kind of has to rescue her, but yeah, it's six of one, I guess, in the way that it ends up. So
yeah, with the shoes, the damn shoes.
Yeah. But one thing I was kind of curious for your opinion about with regards to that is that, obviously, you say that, you know, it very is forward thinking in a lot of ways, but I don't know how I feel about this idea that, like, she's so almost compromised because she just finds him so irresistible because she's just so damn in love. And I'm like, the romantic in me wants to be like, oh, she's in love with romance. But then the cynic in me is like, really? You're almost compromised because he's just that damn hot.
Well, I mean, but wasn't he?
I don't know. Do you think so?
Yeah, I do think so. It was very, very debonair for the time.
Okay, fair enough.
I just recall something talking about kind of subverting expectation, that Martin Landau played Leonard as homosexual. Did you read that?
I have a bit about that in the acting. Yeah, DK actually sent it to me when he knew we were covering this.
We'll get to that in a moment then.
We will definitely get to it. It's a very interesting thing, yeah. And I don't, that's not part of the writing, though, because apparently it wasn't in the script. It was Landau's idea, which I've got it under acting. But yeah, not part of the script, but it did eventually get the approval of the scriptwriter and of Hitchcock. So it's very interesting, an actor that gets to decide that kind of thing. It very rarely happens, especially with a big-name director. So that is notable within itself, for sure.
Right, and for what we understand about this time in history, surprising that it...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Everybody was okay with it.
Absolutely. I mean, again, when I'll get into it, you'll see what I mean, but he basically said anybody that didn't want to see it just wouldn't, basically, because it's not that overt. So, it's one of those things, isn't it? At that time, I think most people would be like, oh, well, just a bit of an effeminate guy or whatever, you know. And, but anyway, I mean, I don't really have much else about the plot because we've talked, you know, about the main parts of it, at least in terms of people that are just coming to this fresh. Like I said, I was surprised to learn it's the kind of basis for a lot of the James Bond archetypes and stuff, but I can definitely see the reasons. Obviously, you know, it doesn't predate the Ian Fleming books, but it definitely does the movies. And again, you can 100% see the influence, especially on the 60s ones. I mean, I could go into a lot of tropes. We'd be here all day. As a James Bond fan, I definitely saw, oh, I know that from that film, and, you know, bits and pieces like that. But And yeah, I mean, this is something I could potentially bring up, is that Hitchcock is often called the master of suspense. And I think there are a lot of moments in this film, at least a couple that spring to mind, that are very suspenseful. Did you feel that way on any moment, or did it kind of just not pass you by because it's maybe a bit dated or anything like that?
I think it was a little bit dated as far as holding me in suspense. But there was the crop dusting scene, which we talked about briefly, that did build up a little bit, but it's not the film's fault. It's more because of, you know, modern cinema and the years that have passed, that Rushmore scene just didn't look as scary as it probably did back then. So I definitely see it, but for myself in this day, I didn't quite feel that build up.
I see. That's weird. I think I was all right with the Mount Rushmore stuff, but I was saying that you are fair. I think the sheer kind of familiarity with the crop duster scene, because it is so famous and you always see it on greatest scenes and all the rest of it kind of thing, that I knew what was coming, and it's played for such suspense that probably would have worked fantastically the first time you'd seen this film if you didn't know what was coming. But knowing as soon as, you know, he got to that, the outcropping in the middle of nowhere, I was like, well, I know what's coming. And then you see the plane. And then, as I said to you, it feels like it's like 20 minutes of dragging it out when he's like, oh, is that the person I'm supposed to meet? I'll go and talk to them. Oh, that plane is dusting where there aren't any crops. Oh, what's going to happen now? Oh, there's another car coming. And I was like, oh, I'm sure this is very suspenseful, but I know exactly where you're going. So I'm just very much get on with it. You know, again, not the film's fault that that's become so famous of a scene that right. It spoils the punchline in a lot of ways, which is that, you know, eventually you get to the plane trying to machine gun him, probably very effective after all that build up, unless you know it's going to happen anyway. So, but yeah, it does kind of take the wind off it a little bit. But yeah, there's other things that I think really work for me. I think the, like I said, the various twists and turns, the not suspense as such, but the sheer frustration of him being completely, you know, screwed over at the start of the movie and nobody believing him. And, oh, no, you're just a drunk driver. No, you clearly were just here for a party, like they're all saying, just pay the $2, etc. I was like, oh, I felt the frustration of that character. I was like, no, this happened, damn it. I always tend to feel like that when these characters go through, you know, crap like that. But yeah, and there's another great moment. I mention it later on, but I may as well mention it here as well. The great moment of suspense when he has to write the message on the matchbook because he knows that they've rumbled her, but she doesn't. And he has to throw it to her and misses. And you're like, oh, God, he's going to read it. And he just doesn't. He like throws it into an ashtray without reading it. And then she sees it. And I was like, whew, that really had me hooked. And like, oh, what's happening here? What's going to, did that not really have that effect on you? Or?
It did. Yeah, it did. And then going to the humor and a lot of these themes that you mentioned too, the humor in the writing was that wasn't dated. I thought that still, no. I mean, all the jokes stuck the landing to me. It was quite amusing.
Yeah, I have a few of them down because I had made a note of a few of them because they're not my favorite line, but I don't like, as you said, there's a lot of sort of humor that really hits in this. Right from the very start, when he's leaving the ad agency and he says to that random guy, I'll say hello to the miss. And he just gets a reply, we're not talking. <That's> got nothing to do with anything, but it does just immediately make you laugh and like, oh, okay, we're going there, aren't we? And yeah, I can't think of I've got anything funny-wise. The rest of the stuff's all just stuff that I was like, this is, you know, it's quite deep and actually quite good dialogue. But there's an awful lot of the kind of banter when they're on Mount Rushmore, but I didn't write it all down because it's very, again, it's something that became almost cliche later, the kind of, oh, we're in danger, but I'm going to banter because I'm a man, you're a woman, ha-ha, let's have some sexual tension.
Well, him playing the drunk was funny, and when he said assault with a gun and bourbon and a sports car.
Yeah, I mean, I've got that under the acting as well. I think Cary Grant actually did drunk acting really well because it's, you know, it's notoriously hard to do.
And then when he bribes his own mother to get the key for 796, he's like, go play innocent and get the key for 796. And he pulls out money and he just starts bribing her and eventually reaches that price point. But I thought that was pretty funny too.
That was another moment of humor, actually.
The tiny razor was funny.
Yeah, when he disguises himself by just completely covering half his face in shaving cream. And then the tiny razor and the guy looks over and I'm like, what?
Yeah, I couldn't believe that worked. What were they looking for if not a tall, slender man with his hair and build?
Well, they wouldn't have seen because he was covered.
Thank goodness. Just in time.
But yeah, that's another kind of bit of humor, but also so is when he's got the porter's uniform, at least I presume that's what you would call it. And then you see the porter to the cops and he's like, oh, he apprehended me, he went that way. And then you see that he just bribed him because he's just counting.
Also, yes. He just keeps bribing everybody and tipping everybody.
Yeah, brilliant. But yeah, I mean, I should make a note of some of the other good dialogue that I thought was just great in the writing. So I do love when she's talking about like, oh, an advertising man can make you do anything, and then he responds, I'm beginning to think I'm underpaid. And just some such good kind of romantic banter, and kind of the way he says to Eve, you could tease a man to death without half trying. And then when she gets really upset with him, oh, who are you kidding? You have no feelings to hurt. I was like, ouch. That's like really should sting, yeah. But then even when she's talking about like, well, why are you getting involved in all this? And she says, it's the first time anybody asked me to do anything worthwhile. I was quite like moved by that. Like, oh, that's, again, that's a huge deal for a woman of this age to be like, I wanted to do something fighting worthwhile. And I, like, I didn't want to just be a homemaker or whatever else, you know? So, yeah. What else have I got there? So yeah, again, talking of humor, I did notice and did appreciate when he's trying to bust through people's rooms, and then there's that one girl with the glasses. He's like, ah, stop! And then sees that it's Cary Grant looking all handsome and that. Like, oh, stop. Wow.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I appreciate what you did. But yeah, so the very last thing I'm going to ask you, because you're probably sick of all these questions, I've got to ask you, did you find the kind of romance scenes to be effective? Because I really loved the scene in the train car. It was a believable kind of seduction for me, even though they were strangers. Did you think the same?
I did. Yeah. Yeah, I did. Because they're both very attractive people.
Yeah.
In a kind of romantic place on a train. Yeah, I did find it believable. Their chemistry, obviously, was really good.
Yeah, off the charts. Yeah, definitely. And again, there's some really cool kind of espionage type things, the way that she hides him in the overhead luggage. And he's kind of grumbling about it, you know, I feel like a sardine or whatever. And, you know, she gives the train porter guy, the key back, oh, like, I think you lost this, which somebody pointed out, like, oh, that would have been a plot hole because she wouldn't have been able to open it without that key. But the film actually goes to pains of telling you, oh, she nicked it off him and then went, oh, did you lose this? So it kind of explains how she was able to do that. I was like, I wouldn't have known the first clue that was a problem, but I appreciate that somebody somewhere did. And they were like, I've got you. We'll explain this.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was all really good. And as you say, the way they were hidden, and I won't spoil my favorite line, but it's from that scene as well. But again, we'll get there. So yeah, if there's nothing else, then we'll move on to talking about the acting, because again, there's quite famous actors involved in this.
Yeah, we're already headed that way anyway.
Exactly, we were, yeah. I mean, I don't have much else to add about Cary Grant. He's Cary Grant and he's doing his thing. It's a very, at this point, it is a character within itself. It's his stage persona. But as I said, his drunk acting really impressed me. I've heard from people in the past that it's difficult to do because when you're drunk, you don't act drunk. You want to act like you're stone cold sober because you're trying to kind of prove not. So it's this weird kind of thing where how do you act like you're fully sober, but you're actually not? You're not in control of that fact, but you're trying to be kind of thing. And yet, as you say, his drunk acting just came off really good. And even his comedic timing during that with the phone call to his mother and stuff, you know, it's a really good scene, actually. So. And as I said, I mean, chemistry off the charts, whether real or not, he's obviously an established leading man. He knows what he's doing with this. And yeah, just pure charming. And I think it's unusual. Like I said, I've seen Cary Grant films where he's the romantic lead or he has this kind of farce going on or this like, what's the word I'm looking for? This kind of screwball comedy kind of romance and banter. But him as a kind of leading man, as the James Bond figure, was a new one to me. And I was like, well, he pulls it off pretty well as well. So, yeah. Any thoughts on Cary Grant I haven't mentioned yet?
Nothing that you haven't mentioned. I just agree that he was very engaging as far as a lead man and pulled it off very well. He didn't come off as too bumbling. But, yeah, that drunk scene was very humorous. His comedic timing is really good. Which could be also more to the directing, but I thought he did a great job. And even in the downhill scene where he's in the car, that was pretty well acted too, because he wasn't it really looked like he was trying so very hard to concentrate. And yes. His surprise. Yeah, everything I think just came off really natural. Like nothing ever took me out of that I was watching a movie.
Yeah, I did find myself, again, not that it took me out of the movie, but I found myself kind of shouting at the character when he thought Eve was a double agent and he's in the room and he's like, no, I'm going to stick by you and we're going to go to dinner. Now I'm just going to go and take a shower. And I was like, hang on, she could have a gun anyway. you're just acting like, oh, well, we'll just casually take a stroll. Here's my clothes. I'm going to jump in the shower. I was like, Jesus, you're leaving yourself at the mercy of this woman, really, aren't you?
Very much. As I said, just a step away from going out in the hallway with the ice bucket over his crotch.
Well, yeah, exactly. But I mean, that was when we thought she was actually, you know, on the side of the bad guys, but didn't realize it was all a bit of a ruse. But and again, talking about like Cary Grant, I do think, by the way, his comedic timing is him, not just the direction, because I know you didn't watch Arsenic and Old Lace, but that being a complete ridiculous farce, he's actually really good for the comedic parts of that. And I thought that was a nice reference potentially to that as well, when he's talking about how he doesn't like the way Teddy Roosevelt's looking at him. There's a runner in Arsenic and Old Lace where he's like, he lives with, I'm not sure if it's his brother or you know, an adopted brother or whatever, but he's basically mad and thinks he's Teddy Roosevelt. And that's like the ongoing joke in Arsenic and Old Lace. So I felt like that was probably a reference for people that knew that film. But yeah, again, the comedic moment of when he's at the auction and he's trying to kind of devise a way to get out of there. So he just acts the idiot, basically. He's like, well, $5, that's all it's worth. We're talking 5,000. So, yeah. he's just bumbling all over the place. Now, how do we know it's not a fake? Well, we know you're not a fake. You're a real idiot, kind of thing. And, yeah, just a heck of a performance, I think, throughout. And one thing that did kind of strike me, again, this is completely just me, but I was taken aback at first seeing Cary Grant in color, because I'd only ever seen black and white movies. And it's one of those things where they seem like actors feel so distant in old black and white movies, like, oh, you know, it's a different time and I would never be able to approach them like, you know, something we would talk to and hang out with. And then you see them in color in a film like this, and it's like, this isn't a million miles removed from my life. They're just people. But again, I think that's one of those weird quirks that I have more than anybody else. So, yeah. So moving on to Eva Marie Saint as Eve Kendall. First of all, I have to say, weirdly, I found this out. Eva Marie Saint is 101 years old and still alive.
I read that too. Wild. I was delighted to hear it. Great for her. I hope she's doing well.
I hope she is too. Yeah, I know that she, I know of her because she played Clark Kent's mom in Superman Returns in 2006. So she was still acting even then. I know that's a while ago now. It's like, you know, almost 20 years, but yeah, still acting, playing a role. And I think she was great in this movie. There's not really much else to add except that she has so much to do, like I said, because of all those twists and turns, and she has to be believable as the seductress, the, you know, the villainess, the actual capable spy, the, you know, the one that's fallen in love and compromised herself. And as you said, I think in a lot of ways she is arguably the lead character. I think if this film was made today, she'd be potentially more central to the marketing and stuff, because there's an argument to be made she is the lead in a lot of ways.
Yeah, she really is. And she's just so pretty and captivating. And like I had mentioned earlier, how a lot of women in a similar role would overplay that, at least by today's standards. Yes. And in this case, her performance was just very, very natural. And I really did enjoy it.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know. Again, it might just be me. And I know that this is, again, it's part of the influence thing, but she did really remind me of Eva Green in Casino Royale, especially during that intro sequence on the train, because that's kind of how they first meet as well, Bond, right? And Vesper.
And the money, yeah.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Every cent of it.
I thought she looked so much to me.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy, just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Yeah, I kept seeing Christina Applegate. I just saw really? Her very much, and whenever she spoke, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Fair. I just think she had the kind of Hollywood glamour and looks kind of thing going on, but also clearly a very capable actress, you know.
Yes.
So, I do have a story about the casting, actually. Her agent had told her that she'd received an invitation to a dinner with Hitchcock and his family, which was the first time she and Hitchcock met. Days after the dinner, Sane's mother called her and reminded her that Hitchcock loved casting women wearing beige clothing and white gloves. So following her mother's advice, she met with Hitchcock again wearing that combination, and she credited this for helping her win the role. So, yeah. Supposedly,
I did find a quote from her regarding Alfred Hitchcock that he told her, "I don't want you going back to sink movies. You do movies where you wash the dishes looking drab in an apron. The audience wants to see their leading ladies dressed up. He saw me as others didn't."
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. That's a really cool quote that you found. Awesome. Yeah, that's great. As I said, I don't think she was really known for these kinds of roles until this, but obviously this would have potentially changed that. Because as I was saying, MGM apparently wanted Sid Charisse to play the Eve Kendall role. But Hitchcock stood by his choice of Saint, and I think wisely so, frankly. So,
yeah.
I'll move on next, because you already mentioned this, to Martin Landau playing Leonard. Again, this is really fascinating. We've already touched on it, but I have a lot of information to go into. In numerous interviews, Landau said that he made a decision on his own to play the character of Leonard as gay and in love with Philip Van Damme. In an October 2012 interview with Devin Faraci, Landau said he was cast in the movie when Sir Alfred Hitchcock saw me in a play called Middle of the Night. "I played a very macho guy, 180 degrees from Leonard, who I chose to play as a homosexual, very subtly, because he wanted to get rid of Eva Marie Saint with such a vengeance. James Mason, to the day he died, he became a friend of mine. The most often asked question of James was whether Van Damme, his character, was bisexual. He said, no, he wasn't, but Landau made a choice and there's nothing I can do about it. I actually caused him some grief. Everyone told me not to do that because it was my first big movie and people would think I was gay. I'm an actor. I said it wasn't going to be my last movie and it certainly wasn't. I've never played a character like that since. I also felt it was something people would know or not know. It was very subtle. I thought in Boise, Idaho, they might not notice." So yeah, that's what I was alluding to earlier, basically. And Landau also said that after he made the decision to play Leonard as gay, Hitchcock and Lehman were very supportive of the idea. And quote, "Ernie Lehman added a line which was not in the script, call it my woman's intuition. It was a very daring line for the 1950s. Men didn't say things like that. Hitchcock loved what I did and left me alone." So yeah, the scriptwriter apparently wrote that line in when he saw the way that the character was being played. And yeah, I mean, it's a choice. I certainly can understand where he's coming from. And it does help to justify the overprotectiveness, I guess, of the Van Damme character and his, you know, aggression towards Eva Marie Saint. So, yeah, and you'd obviously read that as well somewhere.
Yeah.
Cool. And did you think it was effective? That did you know? I mean, you would have noticed, I'm assuming, in this day and age straight away that that's the way he was being played.
Not straight away, because I had read it, but not I read it before I watched the movie on accident. So I didn't know which character it was. I'm real bad remembering names anyway.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until he said women's intuition did I pick up on it. And so now it didn't really, he didn't strike me as particular. Like you said, he wasn't being overly effeminate or anything. So no. I didn't pick up on it until he said that. But even that could be explained away as something funny, as in he has intuition about women, not actually having a women's intuition. So, yeah.
Yeah, or just being sarcastic, you know, like just being ridiculous kind of thing. But yeah, but I think it's a good role. I mean, did you think it was well played? And is there any role in here you didn't respond to? Or did you think everyone was on the top of their game?
Yeah, I thought everyone was pretty good. I had a little issue with the casting of his mother, but and her age and just being so young. Like I think like the housekeeper that was running off to Canada and the one who played his mother should have been reverse cast. But
I see. I know it was Jessie Royce Landis that played his mom. I think she was a known actress, so it's probably more a case of casting somebody the audience might be familiar with. But yeah, there's almost certainly like the wrong age difference there, but that's Hollywood, especially in the 50s, you know. But I think she was good. I mean, especially portraying, like I said, the sheer, you know, the put upon, like, oh, just pay the $2. be done with it. You know? Nobody believes you, kind of thing. And yeah, nothing else to add. Really, I've got down. I thought Leo G. Carroll was great as the professor, but again, it's a role that he became known for. And it's, you know, it's fairly standard. Not to say that it's bad, but it doesn't, you know, nothing particularly leaps out for me about that role. And it's the same with James Mason as Philip Van Damme. I thought very good, very capable, but again, a kind of thankless role. It doesn't stand out in any real way against these other things. And it's, again, it's good, but the fact that it doesn't stand out as bad is a good thing, I think. And I did note the kind of, I don't know if this was a kind of meta commentary or not, but when he says something about, oh, I think the FBI needs to send your agents more to the actor's studio if you're going to be playing around like this or whatever. I was like, oof, is that a dig? But yeah, fair enough. Right, so anything else on the acting that stands out, or should we move to direction?
Yeah, we can move to direction.
Cool. Again, I have a couple of little things about that. First of all, the film's final shot, that of a train speeding into a tunnel during a romantic embrace on board, is a famous bit of self-conscious Freudian symbolism reflecting Hitchcock's mischievous sense of humour. Hitchcock called it a phallic symbol, probably one of the most impudent shots I ever made. Yeah, I have to say, I didn't necessarily pick up on that until I read it, but that was because I was just so shocked at how abruptly the film ends. It just seems to be like, oh, okay, it's over.
That was surprising.
Right. So yeah, 1 minute there, like, you know, hanging from the Mount Rushmore, like, get up, it'll be fine. And then the next minute, oh, get up, Mrs. Thornhill, and then change to a tunnel, end of film. Like, what the heck? That would probably get criticized for some weird pacing these days, I'm sure. But yeah, the final chase scene, by the way, was not shot on Mount Rushmore. Sir Alfred Hitchcock couldn't gain permission to shoot an attempted murder on a national monument. The scene was shot in the studio on a replica of Mount Rushmore, with some footage filmed at the actual monument intercut with the studio scenes. Everything is shot very carefully so as to avoid associating the faces of the monument with the violence, which I assume is something that they were told they would have to do with it being, you know, historical figures or whatever.
It actually surprised me. Sorry. It surprised me that to read that. So it was, when I saw that whole scene, I actually paused the movie and went to read where it was shot, because I actually have been there to Mount Rushmore.
Oh, cool.
And the visitor center has the exact same view of Mount Rushmore, where you're inside looking through glass windows with that same framing up at Mount Rushmore. I had sworn it was the visitor center that I was in, and I was surprised to find out that about, you know, them having to shoot that back at MGM Studios.
Yeah, well, they did a very good job of matching it then in that
case. Very good.
It's not somewhere I would ever have been, but it's one of those things where, again, it's not until I watched this film that it occurred to me that this is like a mountaintop. Because obviously I've only ever seen it from like a distance and the way the faces look, and then it occurs to you like, oh yeah, you're going to be walking around like a nose and a beard, yeah, carved lips and stuff. And when you see it all up close like that, you realize the insanity of what this is. This year, like, wow. It made me want to look up Mount Rushmore. Like, whose decision was it to do this? Who decided who went on there? Who carved it all in and the way it was done and everything? But yeah, it's fascinating to me anyway. Probably because it's not my country more than anything else. But yeah, so it's, I obviously I'd never been there, but you've been in. Would you say it's really cool up close as well?
It is. But what's funny is when you look at Mount Rushmore, it's definitely carved for the looking up perspective. Because when you look at Mount Rushmore from other perspectives, it doesn't even look like faces. So it's kind of like that art nowadays, where, you know, you have to move and view it from a certain angle to actually see everything. It's kind of like that, which I always found really interesting.
Yeah, that's what I meant. I kind of like when you break it down into the way that you're seeing the individual pieces, when you're somebody's like, you know, a human size on it, it's like, hang on, this seems wonky, and that beard looks like it points a little bit too far upward, and that doesn't look like anything from this angle. And as you
and
say,
the glasses.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, cool. As I was going to say, this is something I didn't notice until my research, but if I ever rewatch the film, and I do want to, I'm going to be looking out for this. Hitchcock uses the colors light blue, white, and red all through the film. The blue and white match Cary Grant's suit and shirt, and the red represents danger and appears just prior to when Grant encounters it. Most notably, when Grant is sitting at the auction, a red carnation mysteriously appears around his head for several moments, worn by a lady several rows behind him. And also when Grant walks into the cafeteria by Mount Rushmore, a man is sitting by the door with a red shirt. Then as he orders coffee, a lady dressed in a red blouse steps in front of him. And finally, as he sits down behind a lady in a brilliant red sweater, a few moments later, Eva Marie Saint shoots him.
So, interesting. We also see all the red on all the porter's hats, which,
yes.
Can I just say, there were just as many, there was like one porter for every customer. I think there were so many of them.
I think, yeah, I feel like that was a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek kind of moment, the way it's like, yeah. You know, they can't catch him because there's just so damn many of these. They're turning around every porter. Like, oh, it's not you, not you. It was ridiculous, but I feel like it must have been kind of deliberately, like I said, Hitchcock being tongue-in-cheek in that moment.
Yeah.
Or maybe not, you know. But yeah. So I have a couple of things that stood out for me in the direction that I've kind of noted down. Was there anything for you?
Well, just the, and are we discussing cinematography with direction? Because yeah, we know that is Hitchcock's vision. Just the, in the beginning, that downhill, again, him driving, compromised downhill, and how he's luckily missing all these people, or even how he gets off the cliff, but just how it looks. I was so fascinated by that, how when he is running head on at something, and then when you see it happening, the aftermath behind him, it matched up so perfectly. I was completely impressed. That is something they don't even do that well nowadays.
Yeah, I noted the same thing, because it's a use of point of view that makes it really, it's very visceral and it brings it home. Like you say, you see the thing happening, then you see it in point of view from the character. And they did the really clever thing of sticking the Mercedes symbol in the middle of the camera so that you feel like you are in the actual car looking out during those POV scenes. And I was like, that is so clever. Yeah. It was, and it does, it makes it feel all that more tense and dangerous and like, oh my God, is he going to crash? And yeah, just really good. I mean, there's a lot of, like I said, zooms and dramatic lighting and stuff that Hitchcock plays with. I noted, of course, the soft lighting and the music during the romance scenes on the train. I think that was very deliberate. It got a bit soap opera-y at times there. I've mentioned the long-ass suspense during the crop duster scene. I can't remember what scene it was, but there's a scene where the, and it seems really cheeky, where the scene itself kind of slides as the train goes away, and then the scene slides in to the other side of it. And I was like, oh, that's an unusual scene transition. I love the way that when before he's kind of revealed that he's rumbled, supposedly Eva Marie Saint's kind of being one of the villains, that he gives her almost like a non-hug, and the way Hitchcock like focuses on it and pans around them so that you can see Grant's expression is so kind of like, oh, what's going on? And at the very end, when they're talking about like, oh, well, I like things tidy as well. We can dispatch her from a great height over water. As he says, from a great height, the camera literally rises above him, which again, I was like, oh, cheeky. Only Hitchcock could get away with something that blatant. But yeah, I have to say as well that I was reading about this, that because again, it kind of, I noticed it happening and was like, that's weird. When the professor's kind of giving the exposition to Cary Grant's character and it gets drowned out by one of the plane engines. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's weird. I wonder what that's. But supposedly that was a deliberate choice because it said it basically means that the exposition would have taken like 3 or 4 minutes to fully explain. But this way you can pretend it's been done within like 30 seconds.
They didn't want to bore us with it. That's nice.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was like, well, we can pretend it's over with and, you know everything. So now. So I said, all right. Okay. I appreciate what you did there. I get it. So, yeah, that's all of my notes about the directing and I suppose cinematography and things as well. Anything else kind of stand out to you?
Nothing else really stands out. You had mentioned the crop duster scene, and I think just the, even the shot used here as my avatar, just the way that was filmed was really good. How close the plane really appeared to have brushed by him. I do wonder how they did that and made it appear as if it was all happening in real time. It was really well done.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because that was another thing I didn't write down, but I did note about the direction is that it said that when it came to that scene, they didn't want you to be able to see who was flying the plane. Like, obviously, you can logic it out because there's one of the henchmen that you see at the start of the movie, and then, you know, it says two people have died in the plane crash and you never see him again. But during the scene itself, again, I didn't really notice this. When it zooms in and whatever, you never see who's flying it because Hitchcock said he wanted it to feel like a demon or like some force coming after him. So that way it's kind of, it doesn't connect it to a person if you just don't see who's flying it, and it's all the kind of more scary and more suspenseful. And I was like, oh,
and
okay.
I guess that kind of ties to the twister or the tornado kind of vision, he just wanted it to be a nebulous force, but one that definitely fits more into a real world scenario.
Exactly. I mean, it does, it kind of makes it scary. Like I said, this faceless thing coming after you as a, you know, a machine, whatever it is, and it worked. But as you said, even the framing, I mean, like you can see it in your profile picture there, the way that he frames Cary Grant to the extreme right in the plane coming in on him and gradually kind of coming into his, you know, into his line of sight, as it were, as it starts to shoot on him. Just very well done. You know, very. It's in the negative space and it kind of invades his space. It's so effective. And you can see why it's become so famous. I just wish that wasn't overplayed as much and it was a chance to, it had a chance to kind of breathe within the film on its own. But anyway, so yeah, we've talked a little bit about some of the VFX and production design, I suppose. We've kind of touched on it, but...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I do have a little bit more. So rather than go to the expense of shooting in a South Dakota woodland, Sir Alfred Hitchcock planted 100 ponderosa pines on an MGM soundstage. Which seems excessive, to be honest, but okay.
But those trees were so perfectly placed to be able to see through, but also to give like a sense of density. It was almost 100, too perfect. Though?
100 ponderosa pine seems a little unnecessary.
And planted? Yeah, so that's the other thing I meant. Like, how deep must that stage dirt have been?
Exactly, yeah. Speaking of the crop duster scene, that scene was filmed apparently with a real airplane, while the shot where the plane crashes into the fuel truck was done using large models of the truck and the plane, which I have to say I did not notice. It looked very real to me, so a very effective use of that, the way that the two sort of blend together. And finally, the house near the end of this movie is not real. Sir Alfred Hitchcock asked the set designers to make the set resemble a house by Frank Lloyd Wright, the most popular architect in America at the time. Using the materials, form, and interiors associated with him, the set was built in Culver City, California, where MGM's studios were located, and exteriors of the house, again, were matte paintings, which I would never have been able to tell you. It looked very real to me. So, yeah, just very effective work, and you got to give them credit for, like I said, the way that that's blended together. So anything else from the kind of production design, special effects, or anything like that that stood out?
The interior was supposed to have also, the interior of the UN building was also a matte painting, which I didn't pick up on. But there was one scene, well, first of all, the opening scene with where the North by Northwest grid changes into a building and windows and reflecting the scene below, I thought was really interesting. How the crowd of New York was controlled and, you know, displayed in the background, and just how many people there were. I thought that was really well done. It must have been very hard to, you know, just
plan. To wrangle on stage.
That was pretty much it. There was one scene, an overhead shot, which was very pretty. But you could tell that there was like a fountain below. And do you know what scene I'm talking about? I'm trying to remember exactly when it happened. There's a fountain below. It was a overhead shot, though. I think of the UN building. But that did kind of look fake to me. But everything else, it just blended seamlessly, I thought.
Yeah, I don't really know what you're on about, but I do know, like I said, I did notice when he goes into the UN and meets the real chap that ends up getting stabbed, I noticed everything out of the window looks really fake. It's such an obvious two-dimensional kind of matte painting then. I was like, oh, that's a bit of a shame, but I suppose unavoidable if you're not going to film in a real location. So I presume it was done on a soundstage, which, as you say, probably is to do with the fact that you're not going to be allowed to film in the actual UN building because, you know, politically important, I guess. And the other note I did make, if I was being overly sarcastic, is Nobody in the entire lobby of this building noticed a knife being flung across the entire lobby with enough force to kill someone. Like, really? Kind of defied my belief a little bit, to be perfectly honest. And but I get it. It was necessary to do the whole, oh, he's been found with the knife, which again is one of those tropes that you see so many times now. Somebody gets killed and then the innocent victim picks up the bloodied knife. Oh, it wasn't me.
And the reporter was right there with his camera too, just to flash the perfect picture to show up in the paper.
Exactly,
yeah. So good.
Before we get to the other stuff, then I've just got music and sound as the only other section before we hit our favourites and our kind of critics' response. Again, I don't want to get too bogged down in it, but it's obvious this is a Bernard Herrmann score. He's very effective. Again, if you've seen Psycho, you know what his work is and how iconic some of his moments are, particularly the kind of shower scene in Psycho and stuff like that. And I think that's kind of the stuff that stands out, but there's an awful lot of stuff here that wouldn't necessarily, you know, slap you in the face in that level, but that also I think was really effective. So like the way that the kind of car chase, the excitement behind that, the kind of ongoing repetitive beat of it is really good. The way that, again, the repetition when it's trying to be something sinister, which it reminds me of Twisted Nerve is another Bernard Herrmann kind of bit of composing, shall we say, which they use in Kill Bill to very great effect, as kind of whenever the bride sees somebody she's about to kill, but it's also, it shreds your nerves. And again, I think that kind of, whether you're consciously aware of it or not, it kind of makes you on edge and feel like, ooh, something is about to happen here that's dodgy. And again, as a complete change of pace, just to show kind of how good he is, the way that it's so much more whimsical at the hotel and during the romance scenes, it gets like, you know, quite romantic and quite sort of heartfelt, I guess. So I mean, that was the things I picked up on. Did you notice anything about the music?
I didn't. I'm always really bad about picking up on that, which I always say when I don't, it's good, because it certainly must have lent itself to what I was anticipating. That's what music does a lot, just as you mentioned, but I didn't notice any of it.
So I tell you what, we'll move to our next section, which was going to be the critic's response. As you probably know, if you're familiar with cinema classics, I don't tend to do what we do for the other Silver Screen, which is to ask the audience's thoughts, because it feels like it would be redundant if we're looking at classic films, and because I'm kind of more interested to see how, you know, contemporary and modern critics would review these films. So I have done a critic's response for this, and I've handed it over to Sandy so that you haven't got to listen to me rambling, because I've done enough of it. So Sandy, if you don't mind, take it away with our critic's response whenever you're ready.
All righty. A contemporary review in Time called the film smoothly troweled and thoroughly entertaining. A.H. Weiler of the New York Times made it a critic's pick and said it was the year's most scenic, intriguing, and merriest chase. He also complimented the two leads. Cary Grant, a veteran member of the Hitchcock acting varsity, was never more at home than in this role of the advertising man on the lam. He handles the grimaces, the surprised look, the quick smile, and all the daring do with professional aplomb and grace. In casting Eve Maria Saint as his romantic vis-a-vis Mr. Hitchcock, has plumbed some talents not shown by the actress heretofore. Although she is seemingly a hard, designy type, she also emerges both the sweet heroine and a glamorous charmer. In 2002, author and journalist Nick Clooney praised Lehman's original story and sophisticated dialogue, calling the film certainly Alfred Hitchcock's most stylish thriller, if not his best. The London edition of Time Out, reviewing the film in 2008, commented, 50 years on, you could say that Hitchcock's sleek, wry, paranoid thriller caught the zeitgeist perfectly. Cold War shadiness, secret agents of power, urbane modernism, the ant-like bustle of city life, and a hint of dread behind the sharp suits of affluence. Cary Grant's Roger Thornhill, the film's sharply dressed ad exec who was sucked into a vortex of mistaken identity, certainly wouldn't be out of place in Mad Men. Ah, that's what I had said.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff is things we've said, isn't it?
But there's nothing dated about this perfect storm of talent, from Hitchcock and Grant to writer Ernest Lehman. Co-stars James Mason and Eva Marie Saint, composer Bernard Herrmann, and even designer Saul Bass, whose opening credits sequence still manages to send a shiver down the spine. It topped the box office in the United States for 7 consecutive weeks. The film was nominated for 3 Academy Awards and garnered Hitchcock the Silver Shell for Best Director at the San Sebastian Film Festival. North by Northwest is listed among the canonical historic Hitchcock films of the 1950s, a defining film of his with textbook signature, suspense, and style. The Village Voice ranked North by Northwest at number 49 in its top 250 best films of the century list in 1999, based on a poll of critics. Entertainment Weekly voted it the 44th greatest film of all time in 1999. The film was voted at number 28 on the list of 100 greatest films by the prominent French magazine Cahiers du Cinéma in 2008. In 2010,
Cahiers du Cinéma.
Ah, okay. My French is a little rusty, you know. In 2010, The Guardian ranked it as the second best action and war film of all time. The film ranks at number 98 in Empire's 2011 list of the 500 greatest film of all time. In the British Film Institute's 2012 Sight and Sound polls of the greatest films ever made, North by Northwest was ranked 53rd among critics. As of 2025, North by Northwest holds a 97% rating on the review aggregator Rotten Tomatoes, based on 118 reviews with an average rating of 9.3 out of 10. The site states the critical consensus as gripping, suspenseful, and visually iconic. This late period Hitchcock classic laid the groundwork for countless action thrillers to follow. On Metacritic, it has a score of 98 out of 100 based on reviews from 16 critics. In 1995, the Library of Congress selected North by Northwest for preservation in the National Film Registry for being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. I would say all three.
Yes. And again, take your drinks, sir, because again, that's yet another cinema classic that's been added to the Library of Congress. I think all but one of the films we've looked at have had that honor now. Although sometimes it does make you wonder what took so long. And this is one of those where I was like, really? It was that late? Wow. Okay. Yeah. Cool. Thanks for that, Sandy. That was really good. And I think it gives you a good impression of, you know, the kind of hype this film comes in with and how well regarded it is by most, at least critics and everything. So, yeah.
Yeah. And that people are still talking about it, still reviewing it this many years on.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, yeah, now it's like over 60 years, 66, I think, years after it first came out. So, wild to think, but yeah, especially when you think that, like I said, Eva Marie Saint still alive. You could, yeah. I'd love to just meet her and ask her about filming this movie at some point, but
I was gonna she's probably like, again,
that again, yeah. I've done enough interviews, watch the DVD special features, anyway. But yeah, so that was the critics' thoughts, but we're gonna have to give ours now because that's what we do. So I always start on my silver screens by asking favorite character moment and line. I've got mine kind of planned out, but I probably will be putting you on the spot. I know you kind of know what to expect, but you don't tend to overthink it, Sandy. So do you want me to start by giving you mine? No.
You can. I mean, it was really, I'll just preface by saying it was really difficult with this one, especially because I didn't get to sit with the movie a whole lot, given, you know, when I finally watched it.
Yeah, I kind of felt similar about my conclusion. It was one of those where I was like, I'm going to give a conclusion, but it's kind of only after seeing it once, and I can imagine it will change. So, you know, I'll give you that proviso before we get to that. But for favorite things, my favorite character, I've said, was Eve Kendall. She's not just a love interest. She's a complex layered figure. She blends sensuality, wit, vulnerability, and strength in a way that feels fresh today, for me anyway. And Eva Marie Saint just gives her real depth, shifting between seductress, as I said, femme fatale, and capable agent. And she's the one character that kind of stuck with me after the film ended. Perhaps because I was not expecting it. She's not really all over the marketing and such, and I was expecting a very sort of typical love interest and got a little bit more out of it. So, yeah. My favorite moment is the moment that I kind of talked about earlier with the matchbook and the suspense there. There's something I just loved about it. It's a simple thing. It builds tension and plays with trust in a clever, understated ways. And it's not a flashy, iconic set piece, but it is, I think, a good example of Hitchcock squeezing suspense from even the tiniest little detail. And it had me nervous. So, yeah. And yeah, my favorite line, I've been saving it for now. It's during that kind of quote unquote seduction scene in the train. And it's when they say something about, well, obviously there's only one bed. You know what that means. And she just replies, yes, it means you're sleeping on the floor. I think it cracked me up. It was perfectly delivered, playful innuendo and deflection. Shows their chemistry and also reminds you that Eve is a sharp cookie and she's always going to be a step ahead. So it's funny. So, yeah. So, yeah, over to you. If you've got a favorite character moment in line that stand out?
I do. My favorite character actually was Roger Thornhill, and I think that's because he got all the best lines. It's not her fault. My favorite moment, and I brought it up several times already, was him going downhill in that car and really just struggling to keep his wits about him, and just how that whole scene was shot. Again, I mentioned how when he would be barreling towards something and you would see the aftermath behind him, how seamless and flawless that was. That was my favorite moment for him. He did just get all the best lines, like when he was thrown into the car and he's like, no, don't tell me where we're going. Surprise me. When the doctor asks him if he's been drinking, he's like, doctor, I am gassed. But I think my favorite line does actually go to Eve Kendall. When Roger asks her, how does a girl like you get to be a girl like you? And she says, just lucky, I guess. And especially when you find out like her whole story and how she ended up that way and how loaded that reply actually was, that she ended up falling in love with the wrong man and kind of getting pushed into being this double agent and really just had no choice, unwillingly willing, I guess, to kind of serve her country. So that line just kind of, I thought, encapsulated her whole, it was just so small, three words, but it really just said a lot once you found out her whole story.
Yeah, I think there's a lot that, again, I'd appreciate a little bit more on a rewatch of, like, innuendo like that. Because I'm also remembering when the professor says, like, oh, she had to protect herself. And there's, like you said, there's quite a lot of double meaning in that, like, literality of, like, you got to protect herself by, you know, seeming to be the villain to you and not, you know, coming out and telling you that she's a double agent. But also she's got to protect her kind of heart from falling for you for various reasons, not just the safety of that, but also because, you know, she's been unlucky in love in the past and whatever else. So yeah, I think there's a lot there. And again, probably quite typical of Hitchcock, actually. So cool. Right, did you want to give your conclusion and score first, or would you rather I went first? I'll let you pick.
I'll go first because you always tend to bring it home with your well-thought-out conclusion. So I'll give mine real brief.
I do have something of an essay here, again, I'm noticing, as per usual. So yeah, go for it then.
I was really surprised. It's really hard for me to watch classic movies from this era because I don't identify with a lot, especially when it comes to the dialogue and things of that nature. However, having watched this film, not only did I enjoy watching it, but it's one I am absolutely certain I'll watch again. Probably even like maybe right now I'm kind of feeling like getting back to it and watching it again. I feel like there was a lot of complicated scenes and I didn't get to absorb a lot. And then having heard some things that you've said, I absolutely want to go back and kind of observe for myself. But just the uniqueness and I do see the building of suspense. I definitely appreciated all that about the film, the cinematography, when the film was quiet and when the film was noisy, just really appreciated all of it. I feel the film has held up really well for the amount of time that has passed, and I appreciated all of its forward thinking that obviously lent itself to that. So I just really did enjoy the movie, and out of 5 stars, I would give it a 4.5. I think it's really up there.
Okay, awesome. Right, bear with me while I try and find my conclusion. So yeah, as I said, apologies for the usual essay. I always say that, but I'd like to get all of my thoughts out. And like I said, this is very much a first kind of draft, as it were, the first viewing conclusion. And by all means, my thoughts might well change again. I do want to watch this again, and we'll see what happens then. But for now, first up, let me say this is undeniably a great movie, and I want that on the record. I do, however, think that it's something of a victim of the dreaded overhype. Several of my friends have called it one of their favorite movies of all time, and during my research, I saw just how many critics and film publications agree. For me, though, it's not even in my top three Hitchcock films. Admittedly, that might say more about the man's extraordinary consistency than it does about this film specifically. Hitchcock is so prolific and uniformly brilliant that his body of work is an embarrassment of riches. And of course, personal connections play a part. My own top three, Psycho, Rear Window, and The Birds, just have that extra something special. They grab you and don't let go, and this one never quite did that for me. Don't get me wrong, it was compelling. It held my interest for the most part. And yes, There are a couple of truly iconic moments, though I'd argue they've been slightly diluted by pop culture overexposure, but I found it a tad overlong with some minor but noticeable pacing and editing issues that occasionally took me out of it. That said, the film is obviously shot beautifully with some lovely flourishes and an overall strong sense of style. The performances are excellent. Cary Grant has that effortless old-school leading man charm, while Eva Marie Saint gives a powerhouse and complex performance as sensual seductress, femme fatale, star-crossed lover, and capable agent all rolled into one. The plot isn't without its holes, but the twists and turns are effective and the acting sells the big ideas even when the logic occasionally falters. I know some people will think I'm undermarking this, even though I'm giving it a rating that couldn't be considered bad by any stretch. I do want to rewatch it, and I can already feel that my opinion might improve with time. But for now, it's a strong, respectful 4 stars. A great film, just not one that fully clicked with me the way others in Hitchcock's catalogue have. So I don't think that's terrible, though. So anyway, putting those together, dividing by the two of us here, gives a final score, and again, a very good, respectable score for North by Northwest of 4.25 out of 5. So yeah, I feel like some people will probably still say I'm undermarking it, but again, it didn't quite grab me in that same way. But again, it might on a rewatch. We'll have to just wait and see. So do you think that score's fair, Sandy?
I do think that's fair, yes.
Awesome. Right, fair enough. And that brings us to the end of our cross-country chase through North by Northwest, from Madison Avenue to Mount Rushmore and every close call in between. Huge thanks, as always, to the brilliant Sandy. This episode wouldn't have made it past Chicago without you. Thanks again for coming on. And I always ask this, but I'm assuming you have nowhere that people could find you and nothing you want to plug right now?
Nope.
Nope. Oh, well, I'll see you on Discord in that case. Yes. So, thank you to anyone who stayed with us and enjoyed this trip through classic cinema. If you enjoyed it, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and spread the word, or at least scribble a cryptic message inside a matchbook and slip it to a stranger. You can always stay tuned for our outro, which contains where you can find us all online, or just look at the link tree in the episode description. We'll be back next month for an encounter with another timeless title to unravel as we sculpt out mashed potatoes and whistle a familiar tune. Until then, keep your suits pressed, your secrets close, and remember, in the world of Hitchcock, nothing is ever quite what it seems. Now come along, Mrs. Thornhill. Insert phallic imagery here.
You have been listening to the Silver Screen Cinema Classics Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast. Cinema Classics is hosted, produced, researched, scripted, and edited by Michael Wilson. Additional material by DK. Follow us on social media, our YouTube channel, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Links to all of these places can be found via the link tree in each episode's description. This podcast is a Media Matters original production created by Mike Wilson. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share far and wide. Join us again next time, and hopefully this could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Here's looking at you, kid. Cut!
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.